Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Pivot Podcast. Today, we had a fascinating conversation with Fraser Gray, who's the Vice President of Finance of Sustain Technologies, a company operating in our backyard in Chester, Nova Scotia. This company has access to an amazing technology that can recover and repurpose almost 90% of the garbage that would typically end up in a landfill.
We're excited to share this podcast with you, where you're going to gain firsthand insight into Fraser Gray's vision for scaling Sustain Technologies, all in the interest of ensuring that this world evolves into a more sustainable and cleaner place. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast as much as we enjoyed recording it.
Fraser, we're excited to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Marcel and Jeff.
Fraser, I'm going to start this podcast off, as I do with all of our previous podcast discussions, and the question is around you and how you got to become the role that you're in today, which is the CFO of Sustain.
So story goes back a little ways. 2013, I'm sitting at my house. It's Labor Day and it's raining, and I get this call from my good friend Peter Vinyl from a prior life where I had a similar role with Peter. And he said, I got this idea. It seems a little crazy, and it's about channeling waste. So it started there, actually. And I had a role at the time with InnovaCorp. I was helping companies get started in the clean tech space. And so we started with that. And fast forward to 2018, I had done a few other things while the company was getting formed. I did a few things in industry that were outside of the clean tech space. And it was time to come back and back home, I guess, and take the role as full-time basis.
So let's just move right into it. I'm going to want to spend some time speaking to you about, you know, the actual technology, but why don't you just get us started? What is Sustain Technologies? What are you guys doing?
So we believe that the world has a waste problem. So what we've got is a system, a fully automated advanced recycling system that can separate those black bags that put it on the curb every day. So that's not the cardboard, and that's not the other recyclables. That's the stuff that ends up in the landfill. So we have a system. We have a full-scale plant, first of its kind, full commercial plant outside of Chester at the regional landfill there, where we're doing our thing.
So when you say first of its kind, is it the technology itself that's the first of its kind, or is it the first of its kind in Nova Scotia, or what do we mean by that exactly?
Yeah, it's the first of its kind in the world, actually. This base that we've chosen, which is we're not trying to make energy directly or anything like that out of the waste. We're trying to separate it into things that can be used back into the circular economy. So it is the first of its kind in Nova Scotia. It's the first of its kind in Canada and North America. We believe it's also the first of its kind in the world, and is built on the strong base in Nova Scotia for recycling. And we've taken it, what we believe is, to the next step.
So what are we doing exactly? So let's say we've got, my understanding is you have some garbage, you kind of throw it into the hopper, some portion of that gets converted into various things. So why don't you just walk us a little bit through that process, if you don't mind?
Yeah, I'll give you the overview. So this black bag and a whole bunch of it and a whole bunch of other things like it get picked up on the curbside every week, would be sent to our plant where it's shredded and conditioned, and this entire mousetrap-like set of systems, or industrial systems, put together. And what we're attempting to achieve and are achieving is extracting the clean biomass, because about 50% of that black bag, believe it or not, is a biocomponent. It's packaging. It's the cup that is part of the Tim Hortons cup. It's the cookie bag that's got plastic and paper. So about 50% of that comes out in a clean biomass pellet. About 10% of it is this low-density plastic that we all think is quite controversial right now, which we turn into a liquid fuel, which will replace much more carbon-intensive fuels. So our job is to take that stuff, separate it, and convert it into these clean commodities that can be used back in the marketplace.
So how does this, you know, how far does it go, I guess? So, I looked at the website. I'm just going to read it. You recover 90% of the material found in the garbage bag. So then my next question is always, what's that 10%? What happens to that?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. And 90% is our goal of the stuff that's going to landfill. So that's a fairly high diversion rate. The 10% is going to be dirt and little bits of glass, stuff that comes out of the stuff. I mean, you think about sweeping your floor, there's dirt there. We can't have that in any of those quote-unquote clean streams. So that stuff ends up going back to landfill. But the good news is it's safe. It's inert. It doesn't have any There's no environmental issues with it. And it's really a mixed bag of a whole bunch of small little things that don't matter as much as the things that we're able to clean and extract. Eventually, we believe, and we've started talking to road builders, we believe that stuff would make a good additive or builder in some road building commodities as well.
Wow. So just to provide some additional context here too, for listeners, I think a lot of us have heard this style of technology, let's say, as it relates to mainly construction debris and converting it to biodiesel. Can you comment on how that's, you know, what you guys is different from that, or perhaps it's not? Maybe I'm not sure.
Well, construction debris, it's a different stream of waste, and there are folks that are doing a pretty good job of separating that into, again, commodities like wood, et cetera, that can be used again at least one more time. So that's the essence of recycling. With us, we're dealing with that stream, though, that is a little more problematic because there's a lot more stuff in it. The packaging is actually our target, because the packaging, if you think about all the shipping that's going on in the world today and packaging components, you often have plastic that's stuck to paper, and the packaging industry does a good job doing that. Our job is to take that back apart again. And so it's a little more finely tuned because of the type of waste compared to construction debris. And we're not attempting to turn everything into a fuel. We're taking things such as the biomass. We're not necessarily concerned about turning that into a fuel. There is a good market now for clean biomass. We just want to join that market. Our job is to separate it in the first place.
And the other section, so the 50% that you had alluded to is clean biomass. If I called it wood pellets, would that be fair, even though it's not really wood?
It is. Well, it is fair, because it's the same cellulosic material that's in wood pellets without the lignin in it. Not to get too complicated, but basically, you think about it, it's the same stuff that make up wood pellets is used, the same type of stuff, forest biomass, is used to make packaging. And that's a lot of what we end up taking at end of life and converting a new life for it. So it's very, very similar. And it's come from the original same source.
Fraser, take us back to the beginning when you started to conceptualize Sustain with Peter. You mentioned that this was his brainchild, essentially, but he had always considered you to be his sparring partner, so to speak. So take me back to that day. I believe he said it was Labor Day back in 2013, and he comes to you with this idea. He's looking to you to kind of spar with him to flesh out what eventually became Sustain. If I were a fly on the wall in that conversation, what might I have heard? Can you take me back there?
Sure. And because it's still quite something. And in terms of a sparring partner, how to commercialize, how to turn this into a business concept, Peter had already a strong grasp of the technological aspect of this. It's not mind-blowing, but it's actually a unique adaptation of a technological process that's used in the food industry. So he was really taking something completely off the track it was on, and with the inventor in Spain that he had met, who was his sparring partner on the technology side, had already had that kind of ironed out. Now the question was going to be, all right, how do you turn that into a business? And what can you do with this? And, you know, the conversation, which went for hours then and continued and still continues today, is, you know, how does this evolve so that it's simple enough to be industrial, and simple enough to be repeated around the world so you can actually solve that problem. So I wouldn't say we solved it all that one day in those first few hours, but talking about the commodity markets, because, you know, it's enough of a job just to try and get this technology in place, the system in place, operating at some level of efficiency so that you can actually make that step. And we've done our job there. So the role I would play with Peter is working with him and the rest of the team here in terms of developing connections to the real markets, in terms of those products. And then, of course, on the other side, also working with him and how to attract investors into this kind of interesting approach that we're taking, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. And I mean, just that whole piece around incentivizing people to manage waste efficiently. I mean, you're a finance guy, you are the CFO, but you also speak at a very scientific level. And what you do, I mean, it's part science, part finance, and really there's no precedent. So how do you reconcile all of that and create that demand and create that recognition within the market?
Well, that's a great question. So any good idea has to, in my experience, it has to make a really big difference. Like there's a lot of small improvements we all make every day that, you know, we're creatures of habit. in this case, it was mind-blowing how simple and how straightforward this advantage could be. You know, we're talking about 2.5 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent saved for every 1 ton of waste not going to landfill. You know, and if you think around other parts of the world, so the environmental mandate was kind of mind-blowing. We did that first work because we were asked to by the federal government at the time, but we did that first work around the footprint of, you know, what would this do in terms of the climate change? And it was mind-blowing. So you immediately have people's attention today on that. Then you look at the business model and we say, well, wait a second, there is a tipping fee we get paid to take a raw material. We then turn into products that can be used in the marketplace and we get paid for it. So we get paid once and at a rate I want to highlight this, paid at a rate that is below what the communities charge at the gate. So they're able to keep their economics in line. This is not a subsidy, it's the opposite. But that certainly took a lot of pressure off the conversation when you started talking to the investment community, for example. So those two things together say, wait a second, this is a massive change to the good, and it's sustainable from an economic standpoint, right? So that was kind of the thesis out of the gate. How do you keep it simple? How do you go to the markets without having to create some new product? And how do you apply that technology in a way that's not been done before, creating a difference for yourself?
That's fascinating. And I guess just hearing you speak so passionately about this, you know, you and Peter obviously got excited and you kind of built this from the ground up together. But tell me a little bit about the culture at Sustain. I mean, obviously, you know, the both of you are not an island. You built a team around you to make Sustain what it is today. Just tell me a little bit about the culture and the mindset as you approach your work every single day and what gets people excited to kind of take it to the next level.
Well, that's a great question because we adopted, I'll say this, because if you look at the background of the folks on the team, and it certainly goes way beyond Peter and myself. I mentioned Javier, who was the Javier de la Fuente Munoz, who was the inventor of the core parts of the system. What Peter did, of course, is spar with him enough to get it across the line in terms of making it practical and at scale and thinking about products and the commercial conversations we were having. Robert Richardson, being the third co-founder, along with those two guys, brought an element of commercialization, scaling, financial acumen that's beyond nobody else that's met. So he's been a really important player. Culture from this group of folks that have not come from the startup community turned into a startup type culture very, very quickly. So Peter, AKA Inspector Gadget, is actually very much geared, despite his background, you know, running pulp and paper companies and doing a whole lot of corporate-y kind of things in that industry for years. He's actually an inventor at heart and has a very, very broad base. So the hands-on startup mentality, get involved yourself, you know, was very, very important. As we've grown up a little bit and, you know, we still have that culture, it's going to be more and more about, you know, success will depend on developing leaders, diversifying our group because we're not, you know, we've come from a certain sector that you could easily say that's great, lots of experience, but we need to have a little bit of a rounder picture as we go forward. But I would say what's gotten us here to date is led by Peter, this concept of entrepreneurialism, startup community, et cetera, notwithstanding our backgrounds.
You said so many things in there I wanted to make sure we tackled. Number one, you commented about this being a business. I'm just generally fascinated by any business that, you know, profits from both its inputs and its outputs. So real good on you there. And furthermore, it's always been, you know, my opinion, and I'm not sure why, that it would be the private sector that would work us out of this, you know, climate change issue we face today, let's say, or at least, you know, lead the way, if that makes sense. Now let's come back to you. I mentioned, you know, governments and I want to come back to that, you know, climate change issue and all those things. This technology and what you guys are doing just seems clearly on trend. How are governments responding to this? Like, are there grants you guys can qualify for? Are you really only focused on municipalities? How is this all being received?
Good, great question. Very well. And I'm going to talk about it at three different levels of government. For example, our customer is the community of Chester in this first instance, and they took a big risk with us, with Sustain, to get involved in this very, very first, you know, crazy little mission, which seemed to have all the right attributes, but it hadn't been done before. So, you know, let's say that that's very, very clear. And you know, they're innovative in that they want to take a chance on something new and different. the logic all made sense, but you know, it had to be done. So first and foremost, but of course they have a problem they're trying to solve too. They're the ones with the responsibility for the waste in Nova Scotia. And they're the ones that talk to the consumers, taxpayers, all of us, you know, at that level. So very, very important municipal level. You know, that's absolutely our start and our end to our mission, is to work with this municipality, and then there will be others. And we've talked to many, many others because of their responsibility around waste and them wanting to do something else with it. That's number one. Number two, at the provincial level, very, very important, some economic programs, everything from the capital investment tax credit that the Nova Scotia government implemented, which we were able to take advantage of. And it was available to everybody doing things like anywhere in scope of what we were doing here. As well as, you know, good folks within the economic development community and in that startup community. As I mentioned, I was a provincial employee at the time Sustain got started, working with InnovaCorp. So, you know, that mentoring, the facilitation with the federal level, ACOA, for example, fantastic investors, coaches, you know. So we started the networking, I think, with the feds at that level. We then started working towards something on a little bit larger scale with Sustainable Development Technologies Canada, SDTC as they're known, which is, you know, it's a very, very strong team in terms of establishing clean tech and climate change initiatives. And they've been at it for years. And so if we're on the right side of the pendulum in terms of, you know, wind in our sails, there's a climate change mandate now. This has been going for quite some time with some of these organizations. So Nova Scotia, Chester, the communities in Nova Scotia and the federal government deserves a lot of credit there. And yeah, we've applied for and been recipients of some of the programs that they have, and we're very thankful for that.
If you don't mind me just sitting on that one for a second, why Chester? Why the municipality of Chester to get started?
Well, and most people think of Chester as this wonderful little town on the South Shore. Well, Chester, we're about 20 kilometers inland at their Kaiser Meadow. We're located right at the landfill. It's actually the third largest regional landfill in Nova Scotia after Halifax and then Guysborough. So quite a significant volume, enough to make just about the right size in terms of how to set that first operation in motion. But I got to tell you, it's actually the attitude and philosophy that they have, which is they wanted to make the change, you know, and so it's kind of a combination, but it's very meaningful as a first place to go. And it's not too big, not too small. It was just right. And the people they've been great partners for us.
Playing up what you just said, Fraser, around, it sounds like there's a real sense of cooperation and a shared vision around what sustainability looks like in Chester. And it just got me thinking about kind of what your vision is for what the next couple of years look like in terms of fostering greater cooperation and doing greater good around the area of sustainability. What does that business plan look like? Or that, you know, when would you and Peter kind of sit back and think we've done it? Like we've achieved everything we want to achieve. Well, what does that end state look like for you?
I hope this answer doesn't trouble you, but I don't think it's ever going to be done. There's 7.7 billion people in the world. Think about this. There's 2 to 3 billion tons of waste that goes to landfill every year in the world. Now, and we can't possibly think about solving that entire problem. So, you know, I really don't think we can say we'll sit back ever and say, oh, well, it's all done. I think you have to take things in stages. You have to set goals so you don't burn yourself out. But, you know, this is destined to be something that's going to be used in a lot other locations. And when it comes to the municipality of Chester specifically, and that being our first commercial demonstration, yes, there's more work to do there as well. We'd love to see some of the products that are coming out of there, which is, you know, clean wood biomass equivalent. Clean synthetic fuels that could be used for heating in the municipality. We'd like to create that circular economy. I think that's part of that vision. Even that 10%, you know, going into roads in Chester, that's kind of a cool concept to think that, and it's very economically sustainable as well, to think about not moving a whole bunch of stuff around and allowing that community to take part in their waste being turned back into energy products and other products that their community could use. So I think there's a bit of a vision there. And I think there's clearly a vision to say, wait a second, why don't we do this elsewhere? Because North America has a very similar profile to Chester, Nova Scotia. Other communities in Nova Scotia have a similar profile in terms of the waste that's going there. And that would be a good thing, you know, with all these products moving around the world and all the packaging and other things that go with it, to know that they had a good second use, if not a circular use in our economy. And we could clear up what is effectively about 10% of global emissions by implementing these systems worldwide. So again, sorry if that's too big of an answer, but that's kind of how we think.
No, it's a real answer. That's all we're all we can ask. But I guess just by hearing you answer that question, it got me thinking about the fact that we are in the midst of a global pandemic at the moment, and it's forcing a lot of governments to really look at becoming perhaps a little bit more self-reliant, if that's a fair word. And so to what extent has that helped you or hindered you when it comes to this kind of broader vision of you know, bringing things outside provincial borders and possibly even outside national borders. Is that a factor at all in your thinking of growing and scaling Sustain?
Well, at this stage, not exactly from a practical standpoint, because we still have lots of work to do here in our bubble. but we're mindful that, back to an earlier question about are we on the right side of history with this? I think we are on the right side of history with this, because waste and pandemics are not directly connected, but you know, folks can make the connection. Climate change is an issue, and what we're seeing, you know, Canada with an ability to step up and take a leadership position, and now we believe the clouds parting a little bit south of the border as well. I think we're fine. I think certainly if we were trying to do a whole lot of work outside of Nova Scotia, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, we'd have challenges. But I think it's only going to underrate the long term in terms of what we can do to help climate change, to isolate communities' problems with waste and help them with their economics as well, because that's part of the equation.
So let's linger a little longer on the longer term aspects of this, if you don't mind. We talked about landfills a couple times. You know, how far, you know, right now you have 90% of the material, that's the goal, and hopefully we make it, you know, closer and closer to 100% as everything improves, including the technology. How far does this all go? Like, do we make it to a point where, you know, the facility is so efficient whereby we can keep up with all the garbage that's being created today, and not only keep up with that garbage, but at the same time just start saying, hey, we're going to empty these landfills into the hopper. Now, that might be a very lofty goal, but I'm just wondering, is that at all in the cards here?
Possibly. And I think it's all a question of what's the priority at the time as we kept going. But, you know, one of the things we're thinking very, very heavily about is to make sure we stay two steps ahead in terms of our ability to deploy this. If it works, our problem is going to be how do we do it in more places faster, because we're compelled to do that. But you're right, Jeff. I think what we see is continue to improve the base of the system around the community and squeezing every bit out. And then at some point saying, wait a second, it doesn't cost that much to build a little extra capacity. We're located at the landfill because it doesn't have to change any of the other logistics about waste delivery. We don't interfere with any of that. We're right there. We're the mechanized landfill. Why don't we actually go over there and dip into the and recover some waste that's been buried already and causing problems for communities and the planet? So we've tested some of the materials in the landfill, for example, that's been sitting there for years and years. Plastics don't disappear, so we can still use that. The biocomponents do tend to degrade a little bit, but there's still quite a bit of utility in a lot of the materials there. It won't be our first or our next move, but it's definitely something we've talked about doing. And, you know, you could easily see us expanding or adding capacity as we go here, which is fairly easy to do.
So let's talk about the current state then. Let's move into there. Where are you guys at now? I guess let's start with how much garbage are you processing on a daily or weekly basis, however you guys measure? And more importantly, what hurdles are you guys facing today?
Well, our hurdles, here's the tough love part. Our hurdles today are self-imposed, and meaning we're finding all kinds of little wrinkles in their system as we're starting it up. So we're not in full operating mode yet. We're right at that point where the plant's completely built. It's the machines have been commissioned. There's no heavy duty construction or installation going on, but we found a bunch of things that we need to go fix. Basic material handling, machines not working quite right, and we need another conveyor over here. We need a bag opening system at the front end that we've decided. We need another metal detector. So, you know, blocking and tackling, that's where we are now. But we're starting to test our first products in batch mode, so we're not in full-blown mode because of some of those little wrinkles. And we have our plan over the next couple of months to get some of those wrinkles out, so because we could see the goal line very, very clearly with the product quality samples that we're taking and everything else. So we're still in the mid to later stages of starting up.
So you mentioned a timeline there, a couple of months. Is that where you're kind of hopeful you will be no longer in the startup phase, let's say?
Yeah, it's difficult to predict because as soon as you solve one problem, we have 15 different stages all automated and linked together in this what I call mousetrap of separating. And we keep moving the problem down the field. So we know it'll come to an end at some point. But so our expectation, you hear me hedging a little, our expectation is between now and first quarter 2021, we've got those wrinkles out. And we've kind of established the baseline. And in the meantime, we've also established our first offtakes with customers for some of these commodity products because we're changing their world too a little bit. So we've got an economic advantage. We can give them a really good perspective on you know a commercial deal, et cetera, in the long term. But we've got to go replace products they're using today. So you know we're jumping into that pool as well as we get going.
So if everything goes to plan, at the end of Q1 2021, would you guys be in a position whereby the municipality of Chester was giving you guys all of their waste and you guys were sending only 10% of the overall waste to a landfill?
We expect to be about 50 to 60% volume levels at that point in time, but cycling on a regular basis. So we're at a point where we're sustainable in terms of our own economics. We're taking most of Chester's waste. And then we're starting to look at, okay, typical debottlenecking industrial engineering exercise around what are we going to do next to open up capacities that have been put together for the first time. So we're being a little bit careful. You hear me hedging because we don't know what we don't know about when things are running full out, what that'll look like. So end of Q1, we've lined everything out to get to full nameplate capacity on what we expected in our original pro formas and everything. That'll take a little while after that, and we're just discovering these little tricks as we go along.
One final question on that point of view. I guess it would be my next thought was, how many of these facilities, if they were operating at ideal capacity, would it take to, if I go as far as saying, solve Nova Scotia's garbage problem? I guess what I'm trying to say is, how many facilities like this, if operating at full potential, would it take for us to be self-sustaining our waste, let's say?
That's a good question. So just under 1 million people in Nova Scotia, this plant handles the waste and has this full capacity I talk about eventually, this full capacity of 70,000 tons a year, which represents the black bag and associated waste from about 150,000 people. So that's to give you some perspective. So if you multiply that by six, so six plants this size would cover all the waste requirements for Nova Scotia. So reasonable. What we also believe, though, is it's not a small footprint, but that would be the smallest footprint we would build if we were in another community. If we were in a community like Halifax, for example, we'd build a plant twice the size. And that would be relatively easy to do in terms of the engineering scale, machine capacities, and everything else.
Fraser, I'm just wondering, I mean, it sounds like you're responsible for a lot when it comes to, I mean, clearly you're in the startup phase, there's a lot of things to figure out, but what does the day in the life of the CFO actually look like, kind of current state, and what the future state looks like? Because right now it sounds like you just have your hands in absolutely everything.
Well, yeah, we do have some delineation responsibility, but part of this culture that I referred to earlier is also the ability to overlap. There's a lot of teamwork. The team at Sustain, the extended team at Sustain is used to working together quite a bit. And there's not too much that falls between the cracks. So as you can tell, my role is not typical finance only. I also work with the leadership team on the strategy of what do we do, where do we go next? And also I'm the lead for the commercial undertakings with respect to customers and all that kind of stuff. So I tend to, depending on the priority of the day, I tend to spend quite a bit of time these days on the investor side of the equation, attracting investors, talking to strategic partners. What's two or three steps down the road look like with respect to petrochemical companies that might be interested, large global biomass companies that might be interested, because people are all looking for this waste stream to be a resource, right? And also working with the first customers here in Nova Scotia. So I tend to spend a lot of my time in those two areas. That's probably 2/3 to 3/4 of my time. And the rest of the time, it's hands-on with a whole bunch of other smaller things. But there is a team here, and there, you know, I'm not part of the strong group of engineers, but I stay as close to them as possible to stay up with what's going on. So
yeah, no, that's very evident, and you actually hit on what is now going to be my follow-up question, which is around the strategic partnerships that you've built over the years, because I was interested in learning more about who's helping you tell the sustained story, and you know, what is the response? You know, what do people tell you when you tell such a compelling story? What do you hear out there in the field?
Well, we hear support for everything we're doing, and so that's great. Support, moral support, and of course, we're any company that grows would be lying to you if they said they weren't going to be a consumer of cash. So it's constantly a discussion around, all right, how do we keep that in perspective of where we are, and how do we interact with that investment community? So I mentioned Robert before. Robert Richardson has made a career out of real estate, among other things, but of course the investment community themselves. And so he's been a very, very strong leader in that field to date. And he and I and Peter and the rest of the team are now sort of shifting our focus, not just away from the regional national investors that are involved with Sustain so far, but also thinking about, okay, you know, what does the future look like 5 years from now? And who do you need to be talking to now in order to make sure you're there? Some of them, so the feedback we get is very much in line with the conversation we've been having today. We seem to be on the right side of history. We know that we're working with, we're blocking and tackling here in Nova Scotia, but we're working on something that is going to be much, much more meaningful in other jurisdictions and can be repeated. So waste companies are interested, and there's a number of them we have started early conversations with, and these are North American or global scale. Petrochemical companies, because things like that plastic that's coming out of our system at a very low cost, we can turn into a fuel using the pyrolysis system that we have. That's very interesting to them, not just as a product, but also as potentially a supply source for their petrochemical system, you know, X number of months or years down the road. So they want to start looking at us as kind of an advanced form of research and development for them, and thinking about, you know, how that all works. So it's very early days with companies like that, because they're very, very large. The ones that are going to help a company like Sustain in the long term are going to be very, very large, but they're very much turning their focus towards these kinds of things and are very interested in our progress. So there's a balance there between, you know, the early stage investor and what they're looking for, and that end point, which we believe is going to be one or more strategic partners that would be North American or global in scale.
You brought up partnerships. What about customers? Who's buying the outputs here?
Well, and I'm not really at liberty to talk about names, because we've signed agreements and confidentiality things and everything. But let's just say that from a liquid fuel standpoint, it'll be the largest distributor of fuels in Canada who want to walk down the path with us and start talking to their existing customers about replacing their fuel with this less carbon intensive, more earth friendly fuel. For biomass, it will tend to be biomass users in Nova Scotia, because it's pretty much a standard product and standard commodity for some of them. So think about companies that have a large energy load or are cogeneration at this point in time. Those are the kind of folks we're talking to, and we have our early agreements in place. And the key for them, of course, I've mentioned it before, is that we don't disrupt their process with a new product, even though it looks an awful lot like their old product. So that's kind of where we're doing the waltz with them, I guess.
I think if we did this conversation again, in 10 years, it would be very interesting to see where this all goes, especially, you know, if we're going to say we're in the infancy here. But I don't know. I've known about what you guys are doing over there for a little while now, and I just thought it was the coolest thing that nobody knew about. And this is the whole reason they wanted to get you on the podcast, just because I think people should know what's happening in their backyard and how exciting all of this really is. But with that in mind, we've had you for a little while now, and we're all working under time constraints, so it might make sense for us to stop it there. But I just want to take a second to thank you here. I think there was a lot of value in here for everyone, and I think this podcast is going to spur a lot of interest in people who are wondering and waiting for a technology like this to really take off.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Jeff and Marcel, today. And We certainly want to stay humble in our day-to-day action, but we do appreciate the ability to talk about what we're doing a little bit, and it's not all done yet, but we think it would have some promise, and it is a different approach.
We're rooting for you, Fraser. Thank you so much.